Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Gene Rudd joins us here for the next 20 minutes or so. He's Associate Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association. We're going to be talking about two issues. First of all, the health hazards, the real-life health hazards of homosexual behavior, and the announcement by the FDA to delay its decision on the status of the morning after pill. The Christian Medical Association has things to say about both of those issues, and Dr. Gene Rudd joins us for the next few minutes of Issues Etc. Dr. Rudd, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be back with you.
First, tell us about a recently adopted official statement regarding homosexuality that the CMA put out.
Well, Todd, we're basically saying that, you know, despite our compassion for those who are caught in a homosexual lifestyle, we're concerned about that group of people trying to dictate to our culture and to our society that our institution of marriage ought to change to accommodate them. There are, you know, some common sense issues with that. There are also some significant health issues with that, and there's significant social issues with that. So we want to stand up and say and vote on the side of saying that we think that marriage ought to be between one man and one woman. That's what's been the value system that has kept our country strong and created children for the next generation and grown those children the best. And we know that there's a lot of social and health issues anytime we stray away from that model.
Can you explain a recent statement, this as of today, in fact, from the Christian Medical Association, that homosexual marriage wrongly invokes genetic determinism and defies common sense? What's meant by that?
Well, you know, the press for the last 10 years has been repeating an old mantra that somehow there is a homosexual gene, that somehow people are predisposed to being homosexual. Now, homosexuality is certainly multifactorial. There may be some genetic factors, there may be some environmental factors, there may be social factors, there may be psychological factors that all come into play to determine whether someone has a homosexual attraction or not. Now, that's important that we differentiate between homosexual attraction and homosexual behavior. But the two or three studies that were released in the early 90s that suggested that there was some genetic marker on homosexuals have all been refuted. That data has not been reproduced by others. In fact, some of the fraudulent nature in which that data came about has been subsequently exposed. So as of today, there is no medical evidence that homosexuality is predetermined by your genes. Now, it won't bother me, and it doesn't affect any of the arguments about homosexuality should that ultimately be found not to be true. Say we do find a gene for homosexuality. We might find a gene for heterosexual temptation. We might find a gene for obesity or loving chocolate too much or one of these other things that can plague our life. But we still are people of choice. And we still have the ability to determine the paths that we take in life. And we also have a guide that tells us what paths are best to take for us. And if we follow them, we do better. And knowing that and responding to that creates a better life for the individual and a better life for society. What we're saying is that homosexuality is not predetermined and that people do make a choice about how they express their attraction for one to another and what standards they live by. And that all of us have to do that, whether we have homosexual temptations or not, or heterosexual temptations. But, you know, I think it's important because of the level of sensitivity about this issue and because everybody who speaks against homosexuality is claimed to be mean-spirited. And I certainly don't want to be mean-spirited. Our heart and compassion ought to go out to everyone. We're all subject to sin, all subject to the temptation to sin. You know, for those of us who are subject to homosexual temptation and homosexual sin, we can understand better how someone else might fall into that trap. For those of us who do not have a heterosexual temptation, it's more difficult, and we're not quite as understanding and sometimes not as compassionate as we should be for those. Now, that doesn't condone it. But that says we need to be reaching out in love and compassion to everyone who is tempted or is in sin, whether even including homosexual sin.
Let's talk about some of the real increased risks that are associated with homosexual behavior, and I want to take them one by one if we could. The first one that's listed is tissue injury.
Well, I don't think you want to get into too much detail here, but the actual high-risk homosexual behavior, some of their high-risk behavior, body is just not designed to handle it. No matter what safeguards you take or how careful you are, there's going to be damage done to the body by practicing certain types of homosexual high-risk behavior. And it leads to complications of tissue tearing, tissue damage, bowel dysfunction, infections, and, you know, the list goes on. Those are real-life problems that aren't just dreamt up. The medical literature is replete with articles that talk about these disease problems. Even the homosexual literature and their lay publications talk about these, because so many homosexuals have to deal with these health problems day in and day out as a consequence of the lifestyle they've chosen. It's a big issue in the homosexual community. The gay bowel syndrome, having to do with inflammation and disorders and dysfunctions that disrupt daily life, as well as a whole list of sexually transmitted diseases. So, yeah, the physiology and the anatomy and the biology just don't support that being a normal for our bodies.
Would that then also include the increased risk of organ malfunction?
Absolutely. There again, you know, we talk about this with individuals in our clinic room, exam rooms, but maybe not on radio. But there are definite normal bodily functions that are over time disrupted and sometimes destroyed because of homosexual lifestyle and behavior.
One of the more obvious ones that hardly anyone disputes, that is the increased risk of infectious disease, I assume including also sexually transmitted diseases.
Well, indeed. You know, the one that most often gets the attention is humanoimmunodeficiency virus, or AIDS, the AIDS syndrome. And AIDS is certainly the big bad bully out there on the block, because it's killing people. And it's getting a lot of attention and getting a lot of funded. And you know, my desire would be to see some cure come along. I think that'd be wonderful to be able to cure that disease. There are a lot, you know, whether the disease was acquired through homosexual behavior or through getting a blood transfusion or even by sharing some needle with a drug addict, whatever the reason, I'd love to see that disease cured. But we're not anywhere close to doing that, and AIDS is still killing millions and millions of people. And it's going to kill. In fact, back in the 80s, I predicted that we as a society would not change our sexual behavior until the people right around us started dropping dead with AIDS. And that's coming. That's coming. The even with our new antiviral drugs on the market, we're still going to see an enormous number of deaths in the upcoming years from human immunodeficiency virus. But it's not just that. There's a whole list of some 20 other common and 32 total diseases associated by sexual contact that are plaguing the homosexual community. Hepatitis A, hepatitis B, hepatitis C are some of the newer ones that are now becoming more common in the homosexual community. Gonorrhea, which especially rectal gonorrhea, is a high concern these days. Human papillomavirus, it seems that almost 100% of people who are HIV positive, meaning they have the AIDS virus, are also HPV positive, meaning the human papillomavirus, and 60% of those who are HPV positive are also HIV positive. So there's a large crossover of sharing those two diseases. You transmit it through sexual contact. And one of the consequences, some people think, well, AIDS is the only thing that kills you. The human papillomavirus not only causes cervical cancer in women, killing 13,000 to 14,000 a year, but it also causes penile cancer and anal cancer in men.
Therefore, what can a person who consistently practices homosexual behavior, what can they expect in terms of a lifespan?
Well, 20 years less. That's from the International Journal of Epidemiology. Shows that the average life expectancy for a homosexual male is 20 years less than for a heterosexual male. And that's controlling for a variety of disease processes. Now, you know, we have a large health campaign to decrease the frequency of smoking in this country because smoking decreases the life expectancy by far less than that, say on average 10 years, depending on how many packs you smoke and how long you smoke. And we feel like that's enough concern that we ought to put on every pack of cigarettes and tell every teenager don't start and those who have started to stop. And we ask that those behavioral questions, and we as healthcare providers are constantly trying to encourage people to quit smoking. We have nicotine patches and chewing gum in the stores. And we say, because this is a significant health concern, you should quit smoking. But yet, the society right now is not willing to face up to a much greater health concern for homosexuality. In fact, we're sort of glorifying that lifestyle, when at the same time we're saying, well, you practice this glorified lifestyle and you're going to lose 20 years of your life. How much hypocrisy is in that?
Does it concern you as a physician that not only is the dangerous lifestyle glorified, but when a great number of the homosexual community are dying early, and we're not talking about in their 40s and their early 50s, they are often, it is often regarded as kind of a badge of honor, almost like giving one's life for a cause.
Well, I don't think of it that way. I think it's a tragedy to have someone's life snuffed out that early, well into their, you know, years when they can be productive and have a wonderful quality of life and relationships with others, and to choose to live in a lifestyle, which it is a choice. You know, we're not obligated to live in any particular kind of lifestyle. We choose that, and whether we choose to live a high-risk heterosexual lifestyle or a high-risk homosexual lifestyle, there's still choices. And for us to say that we're going to choose to live in a lifestyle that takes 20 years off our life and die when we're 40 or 50, I don't find anything laudable about that at all.
What do we know about the incidence of drug and alcohol dependence among people who practice homosexual behavior?
Well, Todd, right in front of me, I have a whole list of articles from various medical journals that talk about the high-risk behavior or these health consequences of the homosexual lifestyle. Here's an article from the Archives of Family Medicine that talks about lesbian and bisexual women having a much higher risk of alcohol addiction, high-risk smoking disorders, increased cardiovascular disease, increased risk with cholesterol problems. Here's another one talking about behavioral problems associated with alcohol and tobacco use and obesity, all associated with homosexual lifestyle. Here's another one talking about anxiety and depression being much higher, and suicide being much higher. In fact, there's three articles here in front of me talking about one, the British Journal of Psychiatry, the Archives of Family Medicine, and this other is from the American Journal of Public Health, all talking about psychological anxiety, depression, suicide disorders being much higher. And what's interesting is often forgotten, the risk of domestic safety and health issues are a problem in the gay community. The risk of having a domestic violence in a gay household is twice that of a heterosexual household, and sometimes leading to death, fairly violent issues associated with domestic violence there. Just a whole raft of health issues. And some people say, well, you know, if we just will legalize gay marriage, we will take the stigma away from this, and there'll be more stable relationships. We see from Scandinavia, where the homosexual relationships are much more entrenched in society, that that's not the case. The average homosexual commitment lasts for about a year and a half there. The great majority still inside those commitments are not faithful to those commitments, with only 2-4% being faithful during the time of a supposedly committed relationship. So it's a culture that asks to be identified with marriage, but yet doesn't have any kind of lifestyle that would lend itself to to the concept of marriage.
And, of course, the removing the public stigma would do nothing to mitigate the effects of tissue injury, organ malfunction, infectious disease, and a shortened lifespan.
Not at all. In fact, if we sanction this kind of lifestyle, it may actually increase the health concerns generally across the country because more people will be participating in the behavior.
For the next few minutes and concluding our conversation, Dr. Rudd, I'd like to ask you about the FDA's very recent decision to delay the status of the morning after pill. What is the FDA's decision here, and what is this morning after pill?
Well, the morning after pill is probably better called emergency contraception, or more specifically, hormonal emergency contraception, because there's other types of emergency contraception. And emergency contraception is something you do right at the time or after having intercourse to try to decrease the pregnancy rate. And theoretically, it's used in people who aren't using something more reliable or when that other technique failed. And the idea is to, like I said, decrease the pregnancy rate. The hormonal contraceptive is basically taking a hormone that's used commonly in birth control pills, but use it in a lot higher dose, 10 to 15 times more, and using it in the 12-hour period right around the time that you can use it up to 3 days later to try to prevent the pregnancy. And if it's taken before ovulation, it inhibits the ovulation, the egg from being released. If it's taken after ovulation, it tends to have an effect after fertilization, which is a moral concern. But what the FDA is looking at is the whole issue of whether this, what the safety issues are for the people who take this. And I think more importantly, you have to look at the societal issues for the people who take this in terms of the fact if it's available over the counter, it's going to take the women who normally go in for health care. The primary reason that young women go to see a doctor is to get contraception. And if we remove this motivation from them to go get the health care and go get the counseling, which we know is beneficial, then we're going to remove them from the healthcare system that has the best chance for lowering their high-risk sexual behavior. What we've seen is in the studies, even looking at emergency contraception, where they would give emergency contraception to one group and not to another group, and then look at their high-risk sexual behavior before and after they went to see the doctor to talk about which group they were going to be in, both groups had a reduction in their high-risk sexual behavior going into these studies. Why? Because both groups had an interface with a healthcare system that, because of health reasons, discouraged them from having high-risk sexual behavior. Both groups. Now, what we're saying with over-the-counter is that we're going to take away that interface altogether. We're just going to let 15-year-old girls and 15-year-old boys go out and buy this and not go to see the system that is the most effective in reducing their high-risk sexual behavior and the sexually transmitted diseases and the pregnancies that go along with it. So I think there's a legitimate concern the FDA is grappling with. Unfortunately, a panel that reviewed this advised the FDA commissioner to approve it. The commissioner says, I need more time to think about it. Supposedly, the one side saying, well, he's bending to political pressure, and the FDA is basically saying, no, we need more time to look at the data. And I hope they do look at the data, because the data just is not going to support this being a safe thing for our society to do.
So finally, Dr. Rudd, what does the delayed decision on the part of the FDA really mean? Are they genuinely going to reconsider the data? Are they genuinely going to reconsider the direction they seem to have been headed in, and that was to put the morning after pill or this emergency contraception over the counter?
Well, Todd, that is the question, and I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer. It's up for grabs right now. We can pray, and we can contact the FDA and try to persuade them that this is not good for our society, and we don't want our young people given this tool to use. We don't want the young men in our society going out and buying this and using it as a lever to try to get sexual favors from young women. It's going to happen. It's happening in other countries where this is available. So I think we need to pray about it, and we need to write the FDA and say, don't do this. It's not good for us. And if they'll look at the data carefully, they'll see the same thing. The women in these studies who were given emergency contraception, many of them confessed that they did engage in high-risk sexual behavior because they had this pill available to them. And they were thinking, well, if I can just eliminate my risk for pregnancy, then I won't have to worry about my behavior. But that's totally neglecting the issue of sexually transmitted diseases.
So the concern here on the part of the CMA is not merely the possible abortive function of this emergency contraception, but also the fact that it in studies has not shown to decrease sexually risky behavior among women.
Absolutely. It's not going to decrease sexually behavior. There's good data to support that. And we are concerned about the abortifacient effect of the morning after pill.
Dr. Gene Rudd, thank you for your time, and thanks for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
My pleasure, Todd.
Dr. Gene Rudd is Associate Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association. You can reach them on the web by going to cmdahome.org. That's cmdahome.org.
And Todd, if you have a chance to plug it, on that home page, there's a link to our statement on homosexuality that has with it about 200 references out of the medical literature on the health and social implications.
That's Dr. Gene Rudd, Associate Executive Director of the Christian Medical Association. Well, I said it earlier, didn't I, that false teaching hurts people. It harms people. Now, we readily recognize this when it comes to moral teachings, like the so-called lifestyle of homosexuality, homosexual behavior, deviant sexual behavior. We readily recognize, look, it just hurts people. Besides being wrong and besides being against the Word of God, it hurts people. Why is it we can recognize when false teaching on the moral front so easily hurts people, and we refuse to recognize that false teaching that doesn't seem to have moral implications to it also hurts people just as bad? People wonder, why do you take off against things like the purpose-driven life? Or whatever it may be. Why do you do this? Why do you insist on pointing out these errors? I've come to think of it in these terms. I live in a neighborhood over there in southern Illinois. I take for granted it is a safe neighborhood. I've never had any reason to believe that it's anything other than a safe neighborhood. Small town, out there on the edge of town. The highway patrol sits up at the highway within 300 yards of my house with a direct view of my front door. They're up there every night catching people going up the highway. I feel safe. I feel sound. If there were a rabid dog roaming around in my yard, I don't happen to have a fence. My dog isn't rabid. But if there were a rabid dog in the neighborhood, what kind of a neighbor would I be? Especially if it were happening, say, in broad daylight, right around the time kids get out of school and off the bus, right down at the end of the block. What kind of a neighbor would I be to the people in my neighborhood if I didn't warn the parents, if I wasn't there at the bus stop to tell those kids stay on the bus, if I didn't say there's danger out here, you could get hurt? That's why we talk about false teaching. It's that simple. We'll be right back with more Open Lines.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The teaching of the entire Scripture is made up of two doctrines, the law and the gospel. With the proper distinction between law and gospel, one correctly understands God's Word. Without that distinction, Scripture remains a sealed book. Discover the proper distinction between law and gospel in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, God's No and God's Yes. If you'd like to order the book, God's No and God's Yes, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Call weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Or order online at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find information on God's No and God's Yes and a way to order the book, 1-800-325-3040. Or issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Local and state governments continue to punish the Boy Scouts for banning known homosexuals from membership and leadership. Now, several organizations are asking the Supreme Court to protect the Scouts and other groups, too. Bob Kellogg tells us the case could have far-reaching effects.
The Supreme Court ruled in 2000 that the Scouts can bar homosexuals under a right to freedom of association, but some governments have winked at the decision. Anthony Piccarello is general counsel for the Beckett Fund.
The position of the governments that are hostile to the Scouts is, well, we can't force you to include openly gay people and your highest level of membership, but what we are going to do is make your life miserable if you decide you want to insist on that policy.
Piccarello and the Beckett Fund have filed a friend of the court brief. They're asking the Supremes to review a case in which the state of Connecticut has banned the Scouts from receiving support from a state-run charity.
That hostility is government hostility based on viewpoint in both cases, and that is prohibited under the Constitution.
Several organizations have joined in the brief, including the Center for Public Justice. Senior analyst Stephen Lazarus says the issue goes beyond a defense of the Scouts.
What's at stake here is whether religious organizations are going to receive the same kind of fair and equal treatment in the public square.
Lazarus says unless the Supreme Court intervenes, a government will be able to punish any group that holds a religious viewpoint it doesn't like.
That is, in fact, a beautiful example of a true violation of the separation of church and state.
The brief calls an action like Connecticut's a dodge of the court's 2000 ruling. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Kellogg.
The issue flows onto the federal level and could affect President Bush's faith-based initiative. Some will use this case to penalize faith-based groups that refuse to hire employees that don't share the organization's deeply held religious convictions. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Issues, Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. Bethany Lutheran is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. The Reverend Randy Emmons is the pastor. Their phone number, 618-632-6906. 632-6906. Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights. www.bethanylcms.org.
Issues, Etc. is partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of our Book of the Month for February, God's No and God's Yes, the proper distinction between law and gospel. The cost is $9.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, check out our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. God's No and God's Yes, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February.
Welcome back. The remainder of this hour, open lines for your questions and your comments. One of the things I want to get to here is a question I raised, about 25 minutes ago as we were closing out the first hour of Issues, Etc. And that is, why is it that Americans, when polled, will say to the tune of 60%, no homosexual marriage, when asked, sometimes in the same poll, should homosexual marriage be illegal, they say no, to about the same tune, right around 60%. It appears as though we are of two minds as a people on that very issue. Or maybe it's the way the question is being asked. Now, over the weekend, this was obviously the unfolding story. Did you have an opportunity to talk with someone at church, at dinner after church, with your neighbors over the weekend about homosexual marriage? I mean, you could hardly go any place without it being discussed. How did that conversation go? I'd like to hear about it. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Or maybe you're timid about this. The old saying, of course, the two things you don't discuss in polite company, politics and religion. This one has both, doesn't it? It's a double whammy. It's a twofer when it comes to politics and religion. And maybe it's something that when you get together for, you know, the Valentine's Day dinner at mom's house, you just don't discuss this, not unless you want the flatware flying all over the place and the silverware being or the glassware being broken. Did anybody at your church tell you that what's happening in San Francisco and Massachusetts is no big deal? I mean, I wasn't surprised, but I still think it's a big deal. You can be unsurprised by big deals. But did someone say, oh, come on, it's not a big deal? I listen very carefully to talk radio. I mean, it's my trade, so I listen carefully to what's being said there. And I have noticed that there is a small but significant voice in talk radio flying under the conservative banner that basically says, you know, I don't care. I don't care. As long as my taxes are low and my job is secure and the boys come home from Iraq in a timely fashion and we deal with terrorism and my boy gets elected in November, if people who are of the same sex want to get married, I don't care. It doesn't hurt me. It doesn't change my life one bit. Kind of the libertarian view. Now, the same people will often have perfectly good arguments against gay marriage. They just don't think they're necessary. Now, come on, what is the big deal? I'll be honest with you, folks. There's a part of me that would love to do that. I would love to just say, come on. You know, number one, it's going to happen anyway. There's not a thing in the world we can do to stop this. It is going to happen. This is a force of nature. The reason we can't stop this socially, morally, culturally, politically, is because we let this horse out of the barn so long ago, and it's been running free out across the countryside for so long. To somehow think we can get it back into the pen and close the gate before the sun goes down is just foolhardy. And part of me wants to say, you know, if it's going to happen, why fight? Why even talk about it? Why not just say, look, folks, brace yourself, it's going to happen. And, you know, we might as well just duck, because here it comes. Did your pastor address this in the sermon yesterday? My pastor made mention of it. One singular mention. The sermon was not about that, but he used it by way of an illustration of man's sinful nature. I think he coupled it, if I'm not mistaken, with what happened at halftime in the Super Bowl and gay marriage. He put those two together. My pastor's probably just happy somebody was listening and listening carefully enough to remember it. What about your pastor? Did he mention it in Bible class, in the sermon, to you as you walked out the door? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Is this too harsh an illustration, the rabid dog, be it a moral issue or a theological issue? False teaching is like the rabid dog in the otherwise safe neighborhood. And there are the kids getting off the school bus. They've got to make it down the block safely into their houses. And there is a dangerous dog roaming the streets. What would you do? Would you stay happily in your home saying, well, I'm safe? Would you stand out on the street and yell to the children, hurry home, kids. I don't want to alarm you. So I'm not going to tell you what the danger is. But please hurry to your homes. You know, there are advocates for this view in the church that we should just say, act like it's not there. Act like the dog isn't roaming the neighborhood. And just go to the kids and tell them all about the good dogs in the neighborhood, the ones that aren't going to bite them and give them rabies, the ones that aren't going to be a danger to them when they step off the school bus. Go and talk to them about the goodness of the canine species, rather than warn them about the real rabid dog in the neighborhood. There are those in the church who would say, with regard to false teaching, that it's not a rabid dog, it's a lap dog. It's a dog we can easily pen up. He's not dangerous to anybody. As long as we keep him penned up, he's fine. He's not going to jump the fence or dig under the fence. Given proper help, we can even let the kids in there to pet on him a little bit. He's just a lap dog. False teaching hurts people. You'd be down at the bus stop telling those kids to stay on the bus. You'd be calling your neighbors saying, go to the bus stop and pick up your kid directly there. You'd be warning everyone. You'd be calling the police, wouldn't you? Rabid dog in the neighborhood. And they'd be there on the double. So why do Americans poll so oddly on this issue? This was a story from last week. Oh, we'll get to that a little bit later. I'm sorry. I should be paying attention. For the next 20 minutes or so, we're going to be talking about gay marriage in San Francisco. Of course, the story has been unfolding as we speak. As of the last hour, they're saying more than 2,000 gay and lesbian couples have received marriage licenses. Not all of them have been married, but they've all gone to the courthouse to get their marriage license in that Northern California city. Joshua Cardin is our guest, litigation staff attorney for the Alliance Defense Fund. Now, the ADF has sued to block same-sex unions in San Francisco. Joshua, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's good to be here.
What is the story as of now in San Francisco with regard to this, what they're calling an act of civil disobedience?
You know, Todd, right off the bat there, civil disobedience, the way they use that term is completely inappropriate. Civil disobedience is not about wrecking the structure of the community that you're seeking to change. Civil disobedience is a very calculated act designed to improve, and this is the mayor of San Francisco taking the law into his own hands. This is anarchy. It's nowhere even close to civil disobedience. But the current status of things, as you mentioned, there have been close to 2,000 couples that have gone there to get their marriage license from San Francisco. And the Alliance Defense Fund has filed a lawsuit to stop that. There's a very clear state constitutional provision and state law in California that said public officials cannot violate the law. They can't ignore a statute, even if they believe it's unconstitutional. And that's the claim the mayor is making in this case. He is not allowed to go against that statute unless an appellate court declares the statute to be unconstitutional. The voters of California, 2-1, enacted a statute that says marriage is between a man and a woman, and the mayor is ignoring it completely.
So what do you hope to accomplish specifically through this lawsuit?
Well, first of all, we hope to close the floodgates. San Francisco is being flooded by homosexual couples right now seeking to get marriage licenses. Now, even on the application for these licenses, it states very clearly that these very well may be only valid in San Francisco. And so they recognize that this is out of bounds, but they're unwilling to follow the law in the state, and they're instead just issuing marriage license to all comers. So we're asking for an immediate stop to the issuing of these applications and these marriage licenses.
Are you also asking that the ones that have been issued and the ones that have been acted on, because some of these people actually have taken the licenses and decided to get married later, some of them have gotten married right there at the courthouse, or at least I put married in quotes there.
Of course.
Are you asking that the ones that have already been issued and acted upon be voided in some way?
That will be the very next request. We believe we have a very strong chance of getting the judge to stop the ones that are being issued right now. And are essentially, that is the first and primary importance to get that action stopped. And then secondly, we will turn immediately to the issue of those that have been issued, because, again, those were issued in clear violation of state law. It can't get any more plain than the statute that says only a man and a woman shall get married.
Is this Judge James Warren that we're talking about here?
Yes, it is.
And you're confident of his willingness to grant your request?
Well, it's still a court, and you never know exactly how they're going to rule, but he would basically have to buy off on the other side's argument, which is, despite the California Constitution and despite the clear state law, please allow us to continue issuing these marriage licenses anyway. And so when we have substantial case law saying that officials aren't allowed to just ignore the law, when we've got the very clear definition, the clear message the California voters sent to the rest of the state, marriage is between a man and a woman, we are cautiously optimistic.
Well, I guess I'm wondering, up until this incident, as it began on Thursday, all the conversations swirled around so-called activist judges. This appears to be an activist mayor.
Yes, and he's not even operating within his mayoral framework. That's the amazing part about this, is it's one thing to be frustrated with the homosexual attempts to subvert the will of the people through the courts, you know, where you have unelected judges making the decisions for the country. We don't like that as it stands, but they've gone several steps beyond that, and they've simply ignored, they have usurped the role of the legislature and the judicial branch entirely and said, we don't care what the courts say, we don't care what the legislature has said, we're going to do what we want to do. And if you open that box, you know, where does it stop? That's frightening. And it's the exact same legal position that the mayor would be in if he began issuing driver's licenses to 12-year-olds. You know, no one would have any issue with the fact that that's wrong. It needs to be stopped immediately. We can't have 12-year-olds running around driving. And yet, you know, this is precisely what he's done here. And the only reason that's as controversial as it is because it involves a very hot-button political issue.
Given the fact, I don't know exactly where Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger stands on this issue. I think he's kind of in favor of same-sex unions, that thing. But given that this is a California state issue, and given the fact that this is obviously a violation of state law, do you expect the governor to act in any way?
He's not required to, and that's one of the strange things, is there's no hammer in California. There's no statute provision that says that the mayor will go to jail for violating, you know, for issuing same-sex marriage licenses. However, there is, you know, he does have that option if he wanted to. He does have that option. However, he has issued a statement essentially saying same-sex marriage. He's against same-sex marriage. He's for the benefits, the domestic partner benefits, but not for marriage itself.
The argument being put forth by the mayor is, I think, rather clever, and I think he's taking his cue from the state of Massachusetts, where they made the Constitution, the state Constitution, the issue, rather than any law per se that was on the books or even thought of being put on the books. He is saying, essentially, and correct me if I'm wrong, the mayor in San Francisco, that while the state has a law against such things, he looks at the Constitution and sees nothing specific about this, sees only support for equal protection. Therefore, he thinks he is constitutionally on solid ground to do what he's doing. Is that his basic argument?
Essentially, it must be, and that's a ridiculous argument because that requires him to look at the Constitution with blinders on. He's just the mayor of San Francisco. He's not the supreme ruler of California. And essentially, he's saying, because this is the way I read the Constitution, I'm going to do whatever I want to do with regard to marriage, regardless of what the state people have said, regardless of what the state legislature has said, regardless of what the state courts have said. I'm going to ignore all of that because I'm reading the Constitution, and this is the way I think things should be.
We're talking about gay marriage in San Francisco, at least at the moment. It's a reality. Joshua Cardin is our guest, litigation staff attorney for the Alliance Defense Fund. The Alliance Defense Fund has sued to block gay marriage in this incident in San Francisco. By the way, you can check out the website for the Alliance Defense Fund at alliancedefense.org. That's Alliance Defense Fund, all one word, .org, Alliance Defense Fund. Joshua, I would like your reaction to something that the mayor of San Francisco had to say on ABC's Good Morning America. He says, quote, "I'm not interested as a mayor in moving forward with a separate but unequal process for people to engage in marriages. The people of this city are certainly around and certainly around the state are feeling that separate but unequal doesn't make sense." How do you parse his argument there?
It's quite simple. It's that as mayor, he still doesn't have the ability to take the law into his own hands. He's going on some sort of vigilante quest to stamp out discrimination wherever he finds it. And again, once you open that door, who is he going to deny a marriage license to? Anyone? Can anyone now come to San Francisco and say, I love, fill in the blank, we have a right to get married, and the mayor's going to hand them a marriage license? That's the implication of what he is saying. He doesn't want to pursue a separate but unequal policy towards anyone. Where do you draw the line? Where is the mayor going to stop? What law is he going to ignore next?
I'm curious about the language borrowed directly from the civil rights movement and its rhetoric, separate but unequal. Is there a one-for-one correlation between the issue of homosexuals not being able to marry, and the arguments, the rightful arguments made against segregation during the civil rights movement?
No, not at all. And that's the reason. I mean, I would think that African Americans would be incensed at the attempt to hitch homosexual marriage to a group of people that were enslaved and suffered real actual discrimination. Homosexual behavior cannot be compared to an inherent immutable characteristic like race. And to put those two just don't even live in the same house. Society. The law has traditionally disapproved of the behavior that homosexuals engage in. Its studies have shown it's a destructive behavior, and why should states be forced to legally sanction such destructive behavior? It has nothing to do with race or the civil rights issue of the 60s. No one is saying that homosexuals aren't equal. We're simply saying that there is a list of people that individuals cannot marry, and same-sex relationships is on that list, along with incestuous marriages, polygamous marriages, multiple marriages. There's already a category of people that I can't get married to, and that category includes all of those things I just mentioned, and same-sex homosexual individuals have that same list. And so, once again, if you take one of those categories off the list, you can't come up with a good reason for not taking them all off the list.
So, in other words, if you can redefine marriage to be something other than a man and a woman, you can redefine marriage to be anything other than a man and a woman.
That's exactly right. And that's why it's so important to the Alliance Defense Fund to preserve God's created order. The design for marriage has been and historically has always been between one man and one woman. And Western civilization, every great civilization, has always recognized it as between one man and one woman. And to open up the door, again, where do you stop?
How do you respond to someone who's watched this unfold since Thursday last week and says, look, come on, it's San Francisco. This is just a publicity stunt. If everyone ignores this, it's going to pass within a week. How do you respond?
I respond by just pointing to the number of couples from out of San Francisco, from outside of California, who are coming in to get their marriage license, and they've announced their intentions. The San Francisco Chronicle this morning had a story about a couple from Texas who want to take their marriage license and go and challenge the laws in Texas. People are going to say it's just San Francisco today, and next week it may be their own community. That's why it's so important to stay alert and vigilant in this battle to preserve marriage.
I'm also curious about the speed with which these things are unfolding. It seems to me as though the gay activists and the advocates of gay marriage are trying to get out ahead of any actions that states may take to amend their constitutions, to craft laws that would define marriage as a man and a woman. They're trying to get something in place and challenge the Constitution on this in advance of efforts to block it.
They may have, although in California's case, they just don't care anymore. The fact that the voters of California have spoken and had an initiative passed statewide as the most powerful form of legislation in California defines marriages between a man and a woman. And the mayor of San Francisco has shown that he simply doesn't care about the rule of law. Approximately 37 states have Defense of Marriage Acts in one form or another that define marriages between a man and a woman. And even in those states, if people are unwilling to follow the rule of law, then that we may see situations like San Francisco happening all over.
What do you expect then, specifically in terms of fallout, if nothing is done, if your appeal or your lawsuit is actually denied? What do you expect in terms of fallout from the San Francisco incident?
Well, it doesn't end there. If we're denied by the Superior Court judge, of course, we'll have the option to appeal all the way up through the California Supreme Court for certain. And then if any of these lawsuits if any of these homosexual couples seek to go to another state, we'll have another chance in those states to say, hey, these marriage licenses were invalid from the beginning. They never should have been issued. The mayor acted in clear conflict with California Constitution and California law, and certainly the state of X will not have to recognize this marriage license.
And is this essentially the same situation, not legally in its specifics, but in terms of the strategy that takes place in Massachusetts when, at least as of the present schedule, in May, they'll probably be issuing the same kind of licenses from the state of Massachusetts?
Well, it's going to be a little different in that case, because if Massachusetts does go the wrong way, I mean, there are still some options. The governor, and you know, this is a very careful distinction to make, but the governor of Massachusetts, at least one article has said that he's contemplating disregarding what amounts to an unconstitutional court order in that case. The court, and of course the governor is sworn to uphold the Constitution, just like the Supreme Court of Massachusetts is, and he would literally exercise the power of the governor's office to say, The court should not be ordering something that the Constitution of Massachusetts clearly delegates to the legislature.
With only 2 minutes before we go, two final questions. First of all, should this gay marriage be an issue in the presidential race? And is there any way now that it can't be an issue in the presidential race?
I think it became an issue. It became an issue as soon as it came up with Massachusetts and even here in Arizona. But it certainly became an issue when President Bush came out very strongly in favor of traditional marriage in his State of the Union address. And that's going to force every other candidate and potential candidate out there to have to take a position one way or the other. And so I think we'll hear a lot more about marriage in the days to come.
And are you heartened by the fact that while Bush says he's in favor and will back a marriage amendment defining marriage as a man and woman, he still seems to be in favor of civil unions or the civil union option?
Well, civil unions are not marriage. They're quasi-marriage. They're a way to try to placate the homosexual community, and ultimately they're not going to work. Homosexuals will not be satisfied by civil unions, and so that is a weak attempt to compromise that won't work. This has got to be a cut and dried, you're either for it or you're against an issue. Marriage needs to be and always should be between one man and one woman, and we should resist any efforts to change that.
Joshua Carden, thank you very much for your time. Keep up the good work there. We'll be watching this carefully. Thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
Joshua Carden is litigation staff attorney for the Alliance Defense Fund. They are the organization that has brought a lawsuit suing to block gay marriage in San Francisco as that story unfolds. They have a website, alliancedefensefund.org, all one word, alliancedefensefund.org. When we come back, I'd like your thoughts on this. The question that I posed last to Joshua. President Bush says he will back a constitutional amendment, if it comes to that, defining marriage as a man and a woman. He has also said, not in his clear terms, but he's not said anything to the contrary, of course, that the civil unions option is still open. In essence, he has precisely the same position on this, just in general terms, as his opponent, John Kerry, against gay marriage, for civil unions. What do you think about that? Is that an untenable compromise? We'll talk about it with you when we come back after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.